I'd like now to welcome Andy Barron. He is an international award-winning paper engineer. He is a mechanician. He's a museum consultant. And on Sunday, the 19th of January, this Sunday, he will be speaking at the New Mexico History Museum on art and engineering in the world of Benjamin Franklin. It's the 2014 Franklin Fiesta Lecture, which is at 3:30, and it follows a screening of the film Hugo at 1 o'clock. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Tom Leach joins us. He is director of the Palace Press. Great to have you back on the Radio Cafe.
Always good to be here, Mary Charlotte.
So the film Hugo is about this automaton. Is that the right word?
Yes, I would say it's about a young boy who, through circumstance, ends up with a damaged, almost destroyed automaton, and he thinks that if he can make it work again, that it will have a message for him, that it will write out a message from his father, who tragically died in a fire.
Right, and so the main character, of course, is the boy Hugo, but a central figure in the film is this figure, this beautiful sort of creature almost, automaton. And you yourself were involved in the restoration of, I think, was it an 18th century device of that nature?
Yes, it would have been made in the 1790s, and we know that it debuted in 1800 or not later than 1801. And it was really, for its time and beyond, state of the art. It was the height that technology achieved. And it was the inspiration, this particular one was the inspiration for the book by Brian Selznick, The Invention of Hugo Cabret. And yes, the story does, to a certain extent, revolve around this automaton and what it does, and in fact, what it does quite unexpectedly, which sends the story in a completely other direction. So yes, the automaton, which is a mechanical clockwork figure of a boy that draws a picture, is central to the story. The one that I restored for the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia was a key inspiration for the book, and the book, of course, became the movie Hugo, directed by Martin Scorsese. It was a 5-time Academy Award-winning film.
And the book by Brian Selznick is an absolutely beautiful book with pencil drawings as sort of the main part of it. There's obviously a narrative, but the movie, in its way, follows it to the point where the boy who plays Hugo, the actor who plays Hugo, almost looks like the pencil-drawn character in the book.
Yes, the book is beautiful. In fact, it was a Caldecott medalist. So this is the highest honor in the world of book art. So the book really is a masterpiece of art in addition to being an incredible story.
Now, tell us about automatons and the kind of fascination that they held a couple of centuries back.
Sure. There were a few extraordinary clockmakers in the 1700s that, in addition to making beautiful timepieces, and of course all by hand, there were no factories then, and every part would have been made by hand from designs that they would have created. And these top-drawer clockmakers, to show off their skills and to bring about awe and wonder in their creations, made these mechanical figures. Some were human, and for example, you would have the rider by Jacques Hédreau, the father and son team from Switzerland, who created the an amazing rider automaton that was a forebearer of the one that I restored. And that was in 1772, and it was shown in 1774. Also, there was a musician, a lady that actually played a keyboard, acrobats, and also animals. They were made as as mice that scurried around, a spider that would go around in a spiral, and caterpillars that would move in a realistic way. And these were made with gold and jewels, and they were really made to a certain extent for royalty. An example would be an automaton that would have been commissioned by the King of England to be a gift for the Emperor of China. So this was a very kind of stratosphere world for the height of that art and technology.
If you try to put yourself in that time period, they must have been so incredibly magical, given, I mean, we're so used to technology and film and photography and all these things that take the real world and represent it in different ways. But back in that day, they must have been just otherworldly.
Yes, well, when you think about it, the Meyer de Automaton at the Franklin Institute, the inspiration for the book that became the movie, was one that even today, more than two centuries later, people are still awed and amazed by it. It's the most lifelike of any of the automata that were, that were built, that were made at that time. And so it's quite a haunting thing to watch, very graceful and elegant in its movements and very lifelike. And so if we can respond as we do today to these qualities and can still be awed by it in the 21st century, yes, you're absolutely right. Those that first witnessed it, who would have been born, you know, some of them in the early 1700s, in a world, that this automaton debuted more than three quarters of a century before the dawn of the electric light era, before
right.
the Industrial Revolution.
So they were all wind up?
Yes, they well, very primitive, much earlier ones used other means of power, but yes, this generation basically ran on a clockwork mechanism, so you'd have mainsprings that would be wound up and that would set the action in motion. But in their day, history records that some fainted upon seeing these.
They're also, I imagine, part of a kind of metaphor for the universe and a metaphor for nature that was prevalent at that time.
Yes, not only that, certainly it was that, and a goal of the automaton builders was to create the illusion of life. And as the technology developed, they became more and more lifelike. An interesting irony is that after the Meyer de Automaton, it would be really more than 150 years before another automaton employing modern technology could surpass its lifelike realism. And so, in a way, we kind of lost the art for quite a long time.
We're talking to Andy Barron about automata. Is that the plural?
Yes.
Were these things seen by ordinary people
sure.
in their time?
Yes. When they were on exhibit, they would charge admission, and there would be an exhibition of various automata doing different things. And in fact, there's a lovely engraving in a book, an aquatint etching from 1826 that shows an exhibition of automata in London. And you can see everything from little mice to the acrobat to the lady musician, and the Meyer de Automaton that I restored appears in this 1826 image. Sometimes the makers were, in a way, too successful at creating the illusion of life. History records also that an automaton creation and its exhibitor were imprisoned by what I suppose would be the version of the Spanish Inquisition at the time, the religious authorities in Spain, and they imprisoned the automaton in one cell and its exhibitor in another, so they couldn't get together and do evil things.
Oh my goodness! What was the alleged crime?
Well, again, as you observed, that to the people of that day, this would have been such an incredible thing to see. That, again, it really did blur the line between mechanism and life. And so perhaps if there was a crime, I don't know the details, but it could have been something like only God can create something in his image, and,
right.
and not a human being.
Right. Although, why try to get that automaton to reproduce?
Well, in a way, those that write and draw reproduce.
Well, right now, let's talk about how you got into this. I mean, you have been taking things apart and putting them back together, sometimes better, since you were very small, and have basically made a living doing, what do you call it? You're a mechanician, which is a word I'd never heard before.
Right. A mechanician is somebody who can create mechanism to accomplish specific tasks, and in the case of my paper engineering, which is pop-up books, I do the three-dimensional pop-ups that take up space elevated above the page, and also flat ones that have tabs that you pull or slide, sort of like animating a flat drawing.
Right.
And so the mechanisms for those flat drawings, which are behind the scenes, if you had X-ray vision, you could see inside the page to see the mechanism. That is something, of course, that I have to invent along the way to satisfy whatever it is that we want to present.
So how did you get involved in restoring the Franklin automaton? That's not what it's called.
Well, we would call it the Meyer Day Automaton at the Franklin Institute Science Museum in Philadelphia. And an aside is, and connected with Benjamin Franklin Fiesta, is that the rotunda of the Franklin Institute is the Benjamin Franklin National Memorial. So it's kind of a sacred place for Benjamin Franklin. And I initially was recommended to the Franklin Institute by Brian Selznick, who's the author and illustrator of The Invention of Hugo Cabré. And backtrack from that, it was a colleague of mine, Paul O. Zielinski, who is also a Caldecott Medal recipient, children's book illustrator and creator, actually was having a casual dinner with Brian. Paul and his wife and Brian were talking about Brian's manuscript for what would become The Invention of Hugo Cabré. And Brian mentioned to Paul that he, in his research, went to see this automaton and that it was broken. And Paul just happened to mention that his friend Andy Barron could repair that, restore that for the museum. And so Brian took that and brought my work to the attention of the Franklin Institute.
Now, did your repairing of the automaton influence the narrative of the Hugo book?
Well, that chronology is actually reversed. The sequence of events is that I was the book is what led to the kind of put the spotlight on the automaton at the Franklin Institute, because it is mentioned at the back of the book in the acknowledgments. And so it generated interest in people that wanted to see this amazing, magical thing. And yet it wasn't working, and it wasn't on public display. And at the same time, the Institute was preparing for an exhibit the following year in which they wanted a video of the automaton working, and they didn't have that. So everything was kind of pointing to the fact that they would need to get the machine in working order again. And so it really was the success of the book that led to the automaton being more in the public eye. And, of course, this was 4 years before the movie came out. And the movie, again, put a tremendous spotlight on this artifact. And really, the automaton itself, I think of as reliving its glory days, with all of this attention. But the connection with the book is that before the book was published, Brian sent me the manuscript, and I read it, and I would have thoughts as I would read it. Some things were historical details that I thought could be refined or made more accurate, just a couple of little things.
What year-ish was it supposed to have taken place in?
1931.
Okay.
In Paris. And so, long story short, is I was a sort of a technical consultant and, to a lesser degree, a historical consultant, and to a certain degree, a character consultant for the book. There were a couple of things that I imagined Hugo doing as I read the book, and I would pencil my imagination, you know, ideas in the margins of the manuscript, and then Brian and I would have these long phone conversations. And for the most part, they were technical things about how Hugo would hold a certain tool or perform a certain task. But to a certain degree, there were things that that I imagined Hugo doing that really are, in a way, autobiographical. I imagine him being quite preoccupied and a little bit absent-minded in his focus to get the automaton working. And so there's a scene in the book where he enters his lair, his hiding place in the train station walls, where he's living on his own as an orphan. And in Brian's original manuscript, it says that you know, he turned on the light, and that's all it said as he entered this room. And I read this, saw that he pulled the string or turned the switch, but that the room remained dark. And I thought to myself, well, of course it remained dark because the light bulb is burned out. And of course he hits the switch because he's so preoccupied that even though he's done this dozens of times and he could easily sneak out somewhere and steal a light bulb from some other place in the train station, he just hasn't done it. And so he still forgets. And Brian put that in the book. Another example would be that Brian, there is a scene where Hugo turns the big crank to draw up the weights to wind up one of the large clocks in the train station walls. And in the manuscript, he would go from there to the next clock and do the same thing. And as I read it, I penciled a note in the margin about how, oh, wait a minute, he wouldn't just dash off to the next one. He would pause after he wound up the first one and tilt his head to one side. In my mind, it looked like Nipper, the dog in the RCA logo, listening to the beat of the clock to make sure it was uniform and that he had an assurance that the clock would remain running, and then proceed to the next one. And that was entirely, in my mind, he had to do this for his survival, because if the clocks didn't stay running, and Hugo's uncle, who disappeared, had been in charge of them, then somebody would figure that out, and perhaps Hugo would be found out and taken to the orphanage. So I thought, well, his very survival and the lifestyle he's chosen depends on the clocks remaining running. So I made a note of that, and that's another detail that made it in the book.
We're talking to Andy Barron about automata and Hugo and filmmaking and fixing things. And I think one of the things that I've been wondering about is what it actually took to fix this automaton at the Franklin Institute. Was it, I mean, obviously it wasn't broken beyond repair because you fixed it, but was it in really bad shape?
It had quite a few issues, but most disturbing was that one of them, actually two of them, could result in quite destructive possibilities if the machine were kept in operation. In a way, it was a blessing that it went out of commission, because if it had continued to run, these issues could have caused quite a lot of harm. And so of the many things that I did to bring it back, you know, again, there were just a couple of them that we really needed to attend to right away. The details of the restoration are available as a downloadable PDF on my webpage.
What does the automaton do now that it's fixed?
This automaton is in what we call the writer draftsman class. Those that came before it didn't have it the full capability. This one writes poetry, and it's bilingual. It writes its poetry in French and English, and it also draws pictures, four gorgeous, detailed illustrations, a tall-masted British warship with sails and rigging and little figures on the deck and waves on the ocean and cannons in the ports. That drawing is about, all of its drawings and poems are about 4 inches wide, so that's quite a lot of detail to get in there. Those that came before it were either a writer or an artist, but not both, and their output was much simpler, fewer characters and simpler sketches. One of its forebears was programmable, so that was quite a feat in its day. But the Meilleur des Automaton writes poetry and draws pictures, and literally in almost microscopic detail. There's one of the drawings that the automaton makes is what Meilleur des called Chinese temple. And it shows this structure surrounded by water with birds on the water and a little fence around the water and the temple in the middle. And there's a little figure sitting in the temple and with a kind of a pointed hat. And its head, which is all of 1.6 millimeters from the brim of the hat to his chin, if you look at an original surviving example of that drawing from 1801, all of the features are there, the eyes and nose and mouth, within that 1.6 millimeters. And this was far in excess of the finest writing implement that was known to exist at the time, so that there's another mystery surrounding this automaton and what it was doing so many decades before other technology caught up to it.
Can people actually now go and see the automaton do its thing?
The automaton is displayed as part of the Amazing Machine, which is a core exhibit at the Franklin Institute Science Museum. And the automaton is in a is sealed in a clear case, and there's information about it. Right there on display. And there's a video, it's a 3-minute video that runs on a flat screen monitor just behind the automaton, so people can see it working in the video.
Okay.
And if they're fortunate enough to be there about 4 times a year, it's taken out of the case and operated a little bit.
So an object like the one you're talking about is programmed to do what it does. What is the nature of that program?
Well, the programming, the memory that it has, takes the form of 72 brass discs, and the edges of these discs are cut almost. They have bumps and ridges and peaks and valleys. The discs are about the size of a 45 RPM record, and they're arranged vertically like dishes in a vertical dish rack on a common rod, and they all turn together, and it's a beautiful thing to watch, almost like looking at a music box. And so the edges of the discs with these interesting shapes contain all of the intelligence and the memory that enables the automaton to create its poems and drawings.
And how did the original creator of it, or creators, get the drawing or the poetry onto those brass plates?
Well, unfortunately, there is no surviving documentation about how that was done. We suppose that it was done pantographically, that if the automaton, by having these cam followers, as I call them, riding on the edges of these rotating discs, can translate that movement through linkages and levers and out to the drawing arm of the figure, then it stands to reason that if you were to reverse that and put your hand on the automaton's hand and trace its pen over perhaps an engraving of a drawing, that those movements would, in reverse, go to the cams. And if we imagine that the cams are not already cut and shaped and detailed, but blanks. And if we, at the cam end of the linkage, put a scriber or some kind of marker, then it could, in a way, draw a picture on the sides of the blank cams of what the shapes would be, and then they could take the cams out and cut and file them to these shapes.
It's extraordinary, and we see a version of that in the movie Hugo, which is screening this Sunday. And is there a similarity between what the automaton that you restored does and the kind of drawing that we see the thing do in the movie?
I think the similarity, there's a couple of similarities I could draw. The drawing itself, of course, is very different for the purposes of Brian's story. The automaton draws an iconic scene from the first science fiction movie, A Trip to the Moon, which dated from 1902 and was made by Georges Méliès. The drawing shows a rocket going into the eye of the man in the moon. And so one comparison I could draw is that the man in the moon drawing is quite detailed, as are the automaton's drawings, which are different subjects.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I don't mean mm-hmm. the subject, but the detail mm-hmm.
yeah,
of
the
drawing.
Yeah, the level of detail, I would say, is relatively comparable. Comparison I can draw is that in the movie we watch the automaton first make some disconnected marks, and it's a kind of a dramatic scene because Hugo, seeing this and not seeing the whole picture right away, is completely demoralized that he's failed at restoring the automaton and he won't see what it has to write and this hoped-for message from his father. And then as the automaton continues, he realizes, wait, it's actually putting these lines together and a picture is emerging. And in a similar way, the original automaton, the Meyer de automaton, creates its drawings in segments. It requires three or four complete rotations of its memory of these cams to create a drawing. So after the first rotation, which takes about a minute, we don't see the whole drawing. We only see a part of it.
And is it continually dipping its pen into ink?
Well, that's kind of the amazing thing about this one. The Jacques Hédreau writer, which came before, about 20 years before Meyer de automaton, does dip its pen in ink. The Meyer de automaton, one of the incredible discoveries that that I made in the time since the restoration, and also the detail I mentioned about the facial features in the man in the Chinese temple, it is such a fine line that it can do that at this point we're pretty certain that its original writing implement was what today we would call a stylographic pen, that it had its own ink reservoir, and that it was, this was the era of quill pens, made from feathers, and so that this automaton had such a fine writing instrument 3/4 of a century before such was known to exist in the world is, another one of its mysteries.
So it would be a metal, very, very fine pointed pen with its own ink supply.
Yes. The tip of the pen, as near as I can tell, would have been really as fine as a needle inside an almost as fine metal sleeve that metered the ink in tiny amounts. There's a woman who saw it in 1802, and she wrote to her niece about this incredible thing that she saw. And she mentions that what's amazing about it is that it can create one of these works of art from start to finish without human intervention. And at a glance, you might imagine that she's commenting on the fact that you don't have to get in there and wind it up every minute or two. But if we look at it closer, I think really what she's referring to is that the drawing appears and it keeps writing and writing and writing and without having to dip the pen in ink.
We're talking to Andy Barron, and Tom Leach, director of the Palace Press, is sitting quietly here, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about this whole thing that's coming up, the Franklin Fiesta Lecture. I mean, this is named after Benjamin Franklin.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And you might wonder why.
Yes.
Well, for one thing, the Palace Press is working on a book about Benjamin Franklin. And I have a manuscript from our former director, Tom Chavez, who has been researching the correspondence between Benjamin Franklin and the Spanish court during the American Revolution, which is a very much untold story. And it really sheds a new light on how the Europeans, we think of the French. We learned that the French were our great allies during the American Revolution. And what Tom has turned up is that it was the Spanish behind the French who were making this all happen, making the machinations, if you will, of the American Revolution come to pass. So their money and their influence is what brought the French into the American Revolution. So that's fascinating.
I didn't know that.
I know.
Nobody knows that.
I know. Nobody knows that. It's very important stuff. And then the other reason is just, for a printer such as myself to have original material on Benjamin Franklin is something like a gift from heaven, because Franklin has been written about. I mean, the last two issues of Smithsonian Magazine had articles about Benjamin Franklin. Every year, it seems like there's a new book or two about Franklin out. So he's such an important figure in not only American history, but world history.
And so you do an annual
Well,
Franklin
last year was our first, mm-hmm. and we had such a good time, and we started talking to Andy about it last year, and so I think we would never run out of material. We're celebrating Franklin's birthday on Friday, the 17th of January, I think we could do this every year.
Very, very interesting. So on Sunday, you will be screening the film Hugo at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I have to say, I never saw it when it came out. And so I watched it last night in preparation for talking to you guys today. And it's an extraordinary film. It's the kind of film that I bet a lot of parents went to just because they took their kids, because their kids wanted to see it, and then the parents were as blown away by it as the children were. It's absolutely magical, and it's a film who not only the magic of it and the mechanics of it and all of that, but just the color palette of the film is so extraordinary, and it's, I think, really worth seeing on a bigger screen.
I never saw it on the big screen. I've only seen it. My kids sent me the movie, the DVD. When it came out, it was in 3D, which I can only imagine was
goodness.
Just, but that's so much in keeping with this technological advancement. It's cutting edge.
I suppose 3D is to us what automata were to the people who
could
first
well be.
Saw them.
Could well be.
All right, and with the 3D technology of Hugo in its original airing, or whatever the right word would be for
screening,
on the screen, Scorsese did not want to have it be gratuitous 3D, this comes out in your face kind of a thing. So even the 3D technology of Hugo is a much more refined version of that technology. And so, yes, there's a lot of technological advancement throughout the whole story. The big screen is important because the sets are magnificent. There's a train station that Brian has seen in pictures and wanted it to be for his illustrations in the book. He actually traveled and used his style guides, actual train stations that still exist. There are details of the train station that he wanted, and based on one, if I have my facts right, that no longer exists. And so a set was created for the movie that is as big as this original station, which you would compare, for example, to something like Grand Central Station.
Oh,
so it's
goodness.
Miles high and miles long. Bustling with activity and cafes and booths and
cute little dachshunds.
Yeah, right. Yes, I remember the dachshunds.
You
in
had
the
to
film.
Get that in, didn't
yeah.
you?
Yeah.
Sorry.
So, to recreate in actual life size. It's not done with a miniature. It's not done with CGI. They actually recreated this entire train station.
Amazing.
For the movie. And to see that on the big screen really is incredible.
This movie has such a joie de vivre. It really does. And even though there are some dark areas, it just, Scorsese's love of film comes through in this.
Very much so. Yeah. I mean, a story about the incredible beauty and magic of filmmaking itself.
Yeah.
Well, the film Hugo screens at 1 o'clock on Sunday, and then at 3:30, Andy Barron will be speaking at the New Mexico History Museum on art and engineering in the world of Benjamin Franklin. Once again, it's the 2014 Franklin Fiesta Lecture.
That's right, and we are sponsored. It's a co-sponsorship between the Center for Cultural Technology, a partnership between the Department of Cultural Affairs and New Mexico Highlands University Media and Technology Department, and then the New Mexico State Library and the Palace Press.
And if I may add one final note, part of my talk, which is a slideshow, will have video clips. And so for New Mexicans who aren't traveling to Philadelphia anytime soon, this is really the only other place in the world where you can see the automaton create one of its amazing drawings from start to finish. I have a video of that in the presentation.
And if I may add something on a personal note, my son and daughter-in-law who live in Philadelphia are coming out for this presentation. My daughter-in-law is a watchmaker, as Andy said, who can take a piece of brass and a file and end up with a watch at the end of it.
You guys are totally amazing. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, Andy Barron and Tom Leach, and we will see you at the New Mexico History Museum on Sunday.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
And by the way, Andy Barron's website is popyrus.com, popyrus.com.